How many black block folks did it take to punch Richard Spencer in the face? Okay, let me see. One to organize the community gardens, one to infiltrate the local Proud Boys signal chat, one to manage the bail funds, one to write letters to protesters in jail, one to gather medical supplies for the local tent city, one to write up the childcare schedule for the strategy meetings. I'm Matthew Remsky. That was an anti-fascist dad joke. Did you get it? Anti-fascist courage takes lots of people working together, doing so many different things that physical defense or deterrence is only one tiny part, if it's necessary at all. And that's what we'll talk about this week with the scholar of civil resistance movements and retired Muay Thai fighter Ben Case, author of Street Rebellion, Resistance Beyond Violence and Nonviolence, published in 2022. Excellent book. We'll be talking about the meaning and application of physical courage in anti-fascism and all of the ways in which it can develop. But before I forget, got to do the housekeeping.
It's like, I don't know how you can go out and protest the structure of the entire economic system if you can't keep your room organized.
You can find me on Blue Sky and Instagram under my name and at YouTube as Anti-Fascist Dad. Also on TikTok under that handle, where I try to post about 3 to 4 mini essays a week. My Patreon is at Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast, and it's a temporary paywall for what I believe is essential educational content. So today, you'll hear the first half of my interview with Ben Case, and then you'll be able to catch the second half on Patreon right away. It's up there. Now, in this part two, after the interview, I typically offer some reflections about the guest, but in this case, I'm going to offer some thoughts on the Graham Plattner morality play coming out of the Maine Senate primary race and what it tells us and doesn't tell us about the anxieties of masculinity intersecting with online alienation in the age of fascism. So that's already up there, and it will be exclusive to Patreon for 2 to 3 weeks. And the other series of temporarily paywalled episodes will be a YouTube series called Anti-Fascist Dad Basics, in which I do some workshop work on the key terms that we just can't avoid if we're trying to have a clear conversation about fascism and how to fight it. And the first one of those has just moved to public status, so I'll link to that in the show notes. Lastly, in the show notes, you'll see a pre-order link for the book that this podcast is based on and supporting, Anti-Fascist Dad from North Atlantic. The publication date is April 26th, 2026. Okay, fascist squish and anti-fascist news of the week.
And Mr. President, if you are declaring war against these cartels and Congress is likely to approve of that process, why not just ask for a declaration of war?
Well, I don't think we're going to necessarily ask for a declaration of war. I think we're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country. Okay? We're going to kill them. You know, they're going to be like dead.
I think this is a good place to start in relation to our guest this week and our conversation about the nature of fascist violence and how to oppose it. Say what you want about Trump, but he is honest, outright saying here that he's just going to kill people. Now, if you recall mention recently of the imperial boomerang, this is that boomerang, only it's going in all directions at once. Killing random civilians in Venezuela is of a piece with rounding up random immigrants in Democrat-led cities. So let's check in on the squishes. So what do we see here? Check out this headline and lead from the Financial Times. Headline, "We're going to kill them. Doubts grow over legality of U.S. strikes in Caribbean." And then the lead is, "Critics accuse Trump administration of carrying out extrajudicial killings of alleged drug traffickers." So let me get this straight. Doubts grow over legality of murder. Like, we're just not sure. What does the style guide say? There are dead bodies. Was hitting those personal speedboats illegal, or are those just accusations from critics? In a similar vein, we have the New York Times with this headline, "A mystery in Trinidad as bodies wash ashore after U.S. strikes." Okay, so let me just pause right there to note that Trinidad is only 7 miles off the coast of Venezuela. So, yeah, we have a real whodunit here. But here's the lead. Listen to this. The U.S. campaign targeting what it says is drug trafficking from Venezuela has exposed Trinidad to the fallout. Unidentified bodies with burn marks and missing limbs showing up in its territory. This has got to win some kind of prize for passive voice and strange construction. Let me just read it again. What it says is drug trafficking from Venezuela. Okay, so first of all, don't bother fact-checking. Has exposed Trinidad to the fallout. So the victims here are the innocent islanders who just have no idea what's going on as the bodies just show up like so much flotsam. They're being exposed to the fallout as though we're talking about a nuclear accident or something like that. Now, in the anti-fascist category, I just want to shout out two related groups of people. First of all, the neighborhood watch groups in Chicago who are coming out in numbers every day to chase, obstruct, and verbally abuse ICE agents, often resulting in the goons retreating. So this is men and women, often more times women than men. Sometimes they're in their PJs. Sometimes they're using their phones in really like assertive, sassy ways. Sometimes they're cussing blue streaks like I've never heard before. And previewing my discussion with Ben Case, he basically said this. I'm paraphrasing, but you'll hear him. He says, "We talk about capital P protest, but all protests and demonstrations are just theater for the actions those citizens are able to take when the time comes. They're a demonstration of the fact that we can do things like that. That is the crux of people power." Relatedly, down in Venezuela, shout out to all the women who have been invited into civil defense teams in expectation of Trump invading. Can't believe I'm saying that, but here we are. Now, these women are being given roles in medical support, communications, and food distribution teams. So we're seeing video now of housewives, teachers, and retirees lining up to join local defense brigades, civilian women in uniform armed with semis performing rescue drills, crowd management, and first aid simulations. So I came to Ben Case's work through a weaving together of the stories of two of my guests so far. So last week's guest, Mark Bray, actually pointed me towards Case during a time in which the legacy media was using the term violence as a descriptor in reporting out incidents of confrontation and open conflict around the college campus encampments, like the one here at U of T, Occupy for Palestine, which my week two guest, Sarah Rasik, was a lead organizer of. And increasingly, pundits and news anchors were attributing violence to college kids at a time in which those same platforms were refusing to call Israel's attack on Gaza genocidal. And then on May 2nd, Joe Biden gave a press conference about the encampments that amplified this confusion, and it just happens to be useful for the state if these things are confused. So this is what he says.
So let me be clear. Peaceful protest in America. Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. It's against the law when violence occurs. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law.
So if you listen to the grammar carefully, Biden manages to avoid calling vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations violent per se, but his opening remark frames those actions as violent, and then he contrasts those actions with the notion of the peaceful. Now, he also names threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people, and he says these are not peaceful protest. Now, if those actions cross beyond First Amendment protections in the U.S., they can be against the law, But what Biden was mainly referring to is shouting matches between anti-genocide protesters and supporters of Israel, in which supporters of Israel came away from a protest venue and told news outlets that they felt afraid. And so this concept creep allows some commentators to say that a slogan like "globalize the intifada" is itself a form of violence, and maybe it should even be against the law. Now, Biden's label of violence from above gave Democratic governors in Democratic cities permission to send in heavily militarized police to confront unarmed encampment protesters with armored vehicles, tear gas, breaching rams, water cannons, and non-lethal munitions that can actually be lethal. It was horrible to watch from a distance, and it was made worse by some of the liberal discourse around it punching down on the protesters. Now, I would have hoped for a spontaneous, culture-wide, anti-fascist consensus that obstructing a college campus to force the institution to divest from military crimes and to force the public to reckon with what its government is complicit in is morally good and strategically correct. But what I heard from many liberal and centrist pundits was that the students were breaking rules, and they were breaking windows, and they were being rude, and that that kind of thing would turn the public against the cause of the Palestinian people. The students should be nonviolent, they would say. And that term carries a lot of weight. This was May 2024 when Biden made his statement. This is 8 months before Trump's second inauguration. And now 9 months into term two, we are in an era of mass demonstrations, people picketing Tesla dealerships with a few incidents of Cybertruck vandalism. We have Congress people getting assaulted outside of ICE detention facilities within their oversight jurisdiction. We have clergy members getting hit by rubber bullets and pepper balls. The National Guard is camped out in DC, and whole neighborhoods are using ICE tracking apps to alert each other and come out to confront masked kidnappers. There are so many forms of public anti-fascist resistance and so many questions about how to effectively demonstrate solidarity and provide material protection for the vulnerable. So many questions about the morality and strategy of various kinds of protest. What works? What's the purpose? How does a population apply pressure? How much are folks willing to risk? What does courage feel like as opposed to deference? And this is why I wanted to have Ben Case on. He's a longtime anti-fascist organizer and researcher, and he's also a retired professional Muay Thai fighter. So he knows what he's talking about when he's talking about physical space and confrontation and courage and patience and bravery. In his book, Street Rebellion, Resistance Beyond Violence and Nonviolence, he does this really rich ethnography where he interviews protesters on what non-armed protest and resistance actually looks and feels like, where it is effective, where it isn't, and what lessons of courage and solidarity people learn from it. Now, as my guest on Conspirituality podcast a few months back, I'll link to that episode, Ben and I dug into his research on how the emerging logic of strategic nonviolence often signals to citizens that there is an expert class of protest scholars who know exactly what works, and it all happens to be always nonviolent. And leading this intelligentsia wave is Dr. Erica Chenoweth, who in their 2011 book with Maria Stephan said that they'd proved nonviolent campaigns were twice as effective as violent campaigns in securing regime change. Case examined Chenoweth and Stephan's work to see what definitions and data they were using. And he found that they mostly sidelined the literature and philosophy of anti-colonial struggle. But more importantly, they also worked with flawed data, which failed to distinguish armed violent resistance, i.e. military force, from non-armed violent resistance, on the part of civilians. And this meant that they wound up classifying all kinds of movements that applied non-armed force, like rioting, property destruction, and sabotage, as being non-violent because they didn't involve firearms and didn't cause more than 1,000 casualties. Now, how does this trickle down to concrete examples right now? Consider the encampment issue. There were no direct or forceful actions undertaken during those encampments in the spring of 2024, from property damage to scuffling with riot cops to vandalizing monuments to chanting from the river to the sea, that would have qualified as violent according to the definitions of Chenoweth and Stephan. All of those actions, and it could even be more, like burning cop cars or smashing bank windows or even open fistfights with Proud Boys, say, none of those things would be categorized as nonviolent in terms of that 2011 study. And yet, without this clarity, the moral clout of the term nonviolence can obscure this truth. Now, Chenoweth rode this work to their current chair position as academic dean at the Harvard Kennedy School, and that seat happens to have a lot of influence in U.S. domestic policy. But they have also acknowledged the substance of Case's criticism because he's right. But the upshot of the popularization of the strategic nonviolence technocratic outlook is that now a big block of progressives and liberals have come to believe that civil resistance is only ever effective if people absolutely avoid actions that Chenoweth obscured in their popular study. Throwing things, property damage, fighting with police to de-arrest comrades, and even rioting. What Case makes clear is that movements we think of as being nonviolent never really are. They are messy, emotional, and they usually feature various levels of forceful resistance that can catalyze broader support and galvanize the dignity and will of oppressed people. And I think this is super useful to keep in mind as authorities and pundits throw around the word nonviolence and expend huge amounts of energy and social capital in projects like No King's Day, which is tightly scripted and legally permitted on a holiday to make sure it doesn't disrupt business. Now, there's a leftist argument that a permitted parade with strict behavioral rules, you know, carried out in conjunction with the support of the police, is a form of controlled opposition that provides benign but kind of impotent release of pressure, while it ignores the historical synergy between forceful and non-forceful tactics. That it erases the memory of the violent flanks or even MLK's growing militancy or friendship with people like Kwame Ture before he was assassinated. And I think all of that is very reasonable. But then there's a liberal argument that the parade format provides an accessible entry point for kids, for the elderly, and for other people who might feel too vulnerable to get close to forms of more direct action, but through participation in something like No King's Day can eventually build on or be recruited into commitments and greater bandwidth. And so it can and should be a recruitment event. And I think that's very reasonable and very positive too. I think it's an exhausting argument, but also productive, and I hope it's ongoing with good listening across the lines, because as Mark Bray said last week, a range of tactics and intensities work together. And ultimately, I think we need all of it, from each according to their abilities to each situation according to its needs. We need rallies, demonstrations, protests, and direct action. And I think having a realistic understanding of where violence comes from and what nonviolence means, especially in our bodies in real time, that's a great place to start. So with that, here's the first part of my conversation with Ben Case. Hey, Ben, welcome to Anti-Fascist Dad. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Okay, so here's the big question first. What does it mean to be physically brave as an anti-fascist? And does everyone have access to that?
I guess as I see it, bravery is about being willing to risk yourself for the sake of something or someone you care about, sometimes in unknown ways.
Right.
And there's all kinds of ways to be brave. You know, I like the adage, I don't know who said it first, probably lots of people, but the adage that courage is like a muscle, right? It gets stronger when we practice it.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, the flip side of that is you can also injure a muscle with overuse or misuse.
Yep.
And so I guess another way to put that is there's a difference between bravery, being brave, and being foolhardy. And sometimes you really can't tell the difference until afterwards. And sometimes part of bravery is being willing to sort of push that line. And we all have different capacities to risk things in different ways as well. And bravery shows up differently in different moments. I think you can feel it when it's there. But one of the things about rising fascism is I think it puts us in too many situations all the time, all around us, where we're forced to activate those bravery muscles.
Yeah.
I think that can strengthen us, but it can also easily lead to overuse and misuse and burnout. And there isn't much we can do about that context. We're in that context, but I do think it's important to be aware of it. I guess the other thing I'd say is, since you said physical bravery, in that sense, I think all bravery is physical in a way, because we do everything we do in our physical bodies,
right?
Whether that's using your voice or your body for different things or your fingers to type something. And of course, the consequences of rising fascism happen in our bodies and to our bodies,
right?
Sooner or later to all of us in different ways. So when we look at it that way, I think the difference between, you know, standing up for a coworker with your voice or signing a union card with your hand isn't all that different from joining a picket line or putting your body in between ICE agents and community members. It's sort of a difference of degree, not kind, in that kind of a way. So yes, I think everyone has access to physical bravery in different ways. I think practicing it helps us do it more, do it better. And I think everyone can do things that put ourselves at risk in some way for the sake of our communities or for someone else.
I think it's kind of a false distinction I opened with, which is, you know, is there such a thing as physical bravery per se? Because don't we do everything with our bodies? And I think for the person who feels like, oh, I actually don't feel that kind of courage, it's probably true that they feel another kind of courage or bravery, and that they can access that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, I think different kinds can lead to other kinds, as I said. I mean, I think the more we sort of practice that, the more we get in the habit of practicing that, not just by ourselves in sort of isolation, but with other people and in conversation with other people, I think the better we get at it.
A practical question next that does veer into, you know, the question of what happens in physical spaces with our bodies, and it's also related to your specific research. This is the era of ICE thugs kidnapping people off the street. We've got, you know, 800 National Guard troops in Washington, D.C. right now stopping people for no reason whatsoever. Sometimes these interventions are thwarted by community members who put their bodies in the way. And this is also the era of cops dragging anti-genocide protesters away by the hair or beating them up. And so all of this is very much in our faces right now. And what I want to know from your experience is, what are the top, and also historically, like what are the top physical preparations and precautions that young people should think about when they are heading out to protest, or when they feel they have no choice but to protect their community members?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I go back to, you know, I think physical training is really important. I was a professional Muay Thai boxer in what feels like a previous life.
Yeah.
And I try to stay involved as a coach and as an official in the sport. And I think I found it really helpful, that kind of consensual, violent physical training, to normalize that feeling of physical violence on our bodies in different ways with, you know, with, again, consenting partners and with good training and proper, you know, care, that we can just normalize that feeling of being pushed, being hit, being hurt, sometimes getting injured. So that we're able to better control our adrenaline in those moments when it happens in the street. And maybe it's a cop or somebody else. I found it really helpful to be able to check those feelings. Someone gives me even a violent shove in a crowd, you know, that adrenaline spike isn't there the way it would have been before, because I'm used to that feeling and I can check in with myself. I can stay aware of my surroundings. It can help us distinguish in the moment about whether or not we're hurt versus injured. If your arm is twisted behind your back, you can sort of know a little better if you've done physical or martial arts training. Is my arm breaking or does it hurt like that? Or can I twist my body in a certain way to make it a little better? Or, you know, it can help you stay in the moment and keep your head on your shoulders, so to speak. And can help you, I think, stay honest with yourself about what you're doing and where your values are in the moment. You know, you mentioned, you know, people putting their bodies on the line to protect people from ICE raids or being dragged away in, you know, in protests against US support for the genocide of Palestinian people. And I think it can help check in about like, okay, why are you doing this in this moment? Is there a chance to physically change things in this moment? Is this for spectacle? You know, and if it's for spectacle, is it a good moment for spectacle? It's not always a bad idea to do things for spectacle. That can be really important at times.
Right.
But is this a good moment for that? Is this worth, you know, you can sort of stay more in your body if you have those experiences of little bits of physical violence, again, in a sort of well-curated and consensual atmosphere. Training for fight sports or martial arts can help you sort of stay in conversation with yourself and other people around you when scary things are happening.
This sort of keynote here is normalization, because everything that you're talking about is about not really being surprised and not acting out of a kind of maybe terrified, reactive response, which would be very natural if you are not used to or prepared for, or that you're just sort of instantly morally outraged by the fact that you're being physically assaulted.
Yeah. I mean, to give an example of exactly what you're saying, you know, there was a time that I was being arrested in a group of people in a protest, and, you know, people are being dragged over a wall by cops and thrown on the ground and, you know, again, sort of twisted around. And It's a group where one of these situations where the cops outnumber the protesters in this instance.
Right.
And so, you know, if they want to arrest people, they're getting arrested in this instance. And so, there's one person who got kind of either, you know, pulled or pushed or grabbed and just swung on a cop and just like, you know, hit this cop in the head.
Right.
That's a terrible idea. And that's a sort of reaction that comes from that feeling of surprise and just like, you know, bodily instinct of fight or flight. Which, you know, in that instance is not going to improve our circumstances. There's no way that's going to help us. That's only going to increase the charges and the police violence in this instance. And I think if, you know, again, when people have more experience in that, they can better control some of those, you know, instincts that might be, you know, detrimental in that instance.
And this one other point that I want to pick up on, which is that to know the difference between, oh, I'm being grievously injured versus I'm being restrained and it hurts, and to respond appropriately given those circumstances. I'm noticing this arrest tactic that seems to be very prevalent now of, I don't know what you would call it, but it's like the sort of hyperflexion of the wrist, where, you know, the cop is controlling the detained person by putting them into a kind of wrist lock that looks extremely painful, but I also understand that it's calibrated so as to not seriously injure. I'm not sure if that's true, but it seems like that's one of those circumstances where knowing a little bit about combat sports or combat, you know, experience would give you some insight into what was actually happening.
It's a maneuver that comes from martial arts. Obviously, it's part of a whole, you know, range of things they would call pain compliance. If you want someone to come along instead of telling them or having to take a bunch of people to drag them, if you apply this sort of like painful wrist lock, you know, joint lock, then someone's gonna do what you want. In theory, that's calibrated. Sure. I mean, I still don't know if that's wouldn't support that sort of idea. I think that, you know, whatever, there's a whole other range of things I think about policing, but I certainly wouldn't trust, you know, John Q police officer to correctly calibrate that in the moment.
Right.
They have emotions too. They have adrenaline too. They have their own feelings and, you know, individual politics and constraints and pressures as well. And not all of them are super well trained either. So I wouldn't, I wouldn't assume that they know what they're doing when they apply things. I mean, look how many times people, I mean, God forbid, like look how many times people have applied chokeholds or something like that and killed people.
Of course. Right.
You know, so it's, I certainly wouldn't trust them for that, but yeah, that's a great example of like, if that's sort of happening, sort of knowing where you are in your body and how you can adjust and what's happening to you and being able to think in the moment better than you would otherwise if you hadn't felt something like that before.
Okay, so moving into your work on the history of street rebellion, there's this idea that I grew up with that the perfect protest should never involve confrontation with counter-protesters or with the police. Now, why do you think I grew up with that idea? I know that you've studied it a lot, but where does it come from and why was it so common?
I think a lot of us grew up with a notion of protest that comes from a kind of whitewashed story of the civil rights movement, where we get images maybe in black and white, which make it seem like it's a, you know, something out of time, where people protested in ways that were, you know, respectful and respectable, and they, you know, walked in the street peacefully, and they had signs that were either, you know, poignant or clever, and then dot, 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 society changed.
You know what? I'm just thinking, too, about the black and white photographs. I've never thought about this, but the fact that those guys are all in fantastic suits, I think, seems to make a difference, don't you think?
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, those were real things that happened. There were, you know, the March on Montgomery did involve a lot of people who were dressed in suits and was people who were trying to march peacefully. Like, that's a real thing.
Yeah.
But, of course, that whitewashed version of the entire era, first of all, it takes that specific tactic out of context, even in for the civil rights movement and the Southern Christian Leadership Council. And, like, that was a specific tactic that they planned to do for certain reasons. In that case, they were correct. They assessed that if they engage in that kind of protest in a mass way, that police violence against those protests at times would backfire,
right,
and would outrage people. That worked in that instance, in some cases. But the first thing is that that was also paired with lots of other types of direct action, including, you know, the like lunch counter sit-ins, which were directly disruptive, which they knew they would be engaged by people who were upset by that, who would physically assault them, even arrest them. They knew there would be confrontations. And, you know, that in the entire sort of nonviolent civil rights apparatus was also happening in the context of a lot of other types of physical action, like urban uprisings and a sort of a global context where there were imperial wars happening in different places and armed counterinsurgency. And so
right. All
that was sort of in context. And so when that one part gets excerpted and just sort of like, you know, put out there and taught as though that's what protest is, then we get this idea that, okay, so if we want to change the world, you know, outside of voting or whatever else, then we need to join a march and the march should be peaceful and orderly. And then again, there's sort of an ellipsis there, but then something changes. I don't think that's realistic, but I think that that is where that comes from. And I think it's deeply embedded and ingrained in a lot of folks' minds, even people who are, you know, practiced in what we would call hashtag resistance,
right,
you know, to the Trump regime. I think that's really deeply ingrained in a lot of people that that's how political change happens. It can be polite and orderly.
Well, I'm just thinking about how if I sort of go back into my memory at 12, 13, 14 years old, when I first started becoming aware of civil rights activism, I think the predominant image is not just the tableau of, you know, guys in suits on that bridge, but also they're singing "We Shall Overcome" and it sounds beautiful, right? It's later that I think I realize, oh, there's also footage of rioting and police brutality and German shepherds, you know, chowing down on people. And that came later. It's at the periphery. But I think that there's almost a fetish and an idealization of the dignity of the outcome, right? Rather than the process.
Yeah. And I think that there's, you know, for different people in different moments, humans are complex, obviously. And I think there's a certain type of dignity that comes from that type of a peaceful march in well-dressed clothing. There's a different type of dignity that comes from a physical rebellion against repression. And that sort of dignity is also really important for, you know, for people in different instances. In that context, I want to also shout out a great book on this by Elizabeth Hinton called America on Fire, that talks that deals with some of these exact things, and telling that story of urban rebellions as the central part of Black-led resistance against white supremacy in America.
Well, let's kind of turn to that, because in your own book, you describe learning from protesters in South Africa who would make this distinction between what they called little violence and big violence. So what were they telling you about that?
Yeah, this was a quote that came from one particular student that I was interviewing, and he was trying to articulate a difference. You know, so I was studying for my doctoral dissertation. I studied riots and nonviolent protest and the way we talk about violence and nonviolence in social movements. And I was interviewing students in South Africa who had been part of this student rebellion in, you know, between 2015 and 17, roughly. It was sort of a lot of things that were going on campuses in the moment. And there were, you know, campus occupations, and there were protests, and there were labor strikes, and there were, you know, fights between protesters and police and security guards and things like that. And so I was trying to dig into the ways some of these folks thought about violence and nonviolence. And this distinction between little violence and big violence was this one guy's way of trying to get through, like, yeah, okay, when we throw rocks and bottles at security, when they're trying to, you know, push us off of our campus because we have all these grievances, and, you know, yeah, that's violent in a sense. It's not violent, right? It is, but it's not comparable to the systemic racialized poverty in South African society that was driving a lot of these movements, right? At the core, when they're trying to raise prices on students, that would be, you know, that would basically mean that whole swaths of society would be unable to attend higher education, you know, overwhelmingly Black people. Then, you know, that's enacting violence. That's much bigger violence than throwing a bottle at security. And so, you know, I think this is where, like, a lot of us would call the big violence, you know, systemic violence, or, you know, if you're into this kind of a theory, Pierre Bourdieu calls this symbolic violence, or there's lots of terms for this, but I think they're all trying to get a grip on the fact that, like, the word violence is, like, contains a lot in there.
Right.
And sometimes when we use that to talk about, for example, protests, it can confuse us into thinking that's the same thing.
Right.
As, you know, mass incarceration, for example, or, you know, state violence, right, all the way up to genocide. This is all violence. And no, these are like categorically different types of things. So that's, I think, what he was getting at with that distinction.
Well, and when that's confused, the consequences are severe. I mean, I remember 2024, the spring, Biden comes out and sort of announces that the anti-genocide, pro-Palestinian protests on university campuses are violent. And what he's responding to is, you know, the occupation of Heinz Hall, you know, some broken windows, the fact that classes are disrupted a little bit, there's some graffiti, and there's this sort of wave, all of those things then are said to have crossed a line into unacceptability. And that discussion then completely erases the fact that the actual sort of subject matter of the protest is the carpet bombing of this occupied territory. And that is very severe, actually, that conflation of little and big violence.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, on the sort of level of, like, the discourse about it, the consequence is that, you know, it traps people into... you know, this problem of, they say, well, that's violent, you know, graffitiing or like pushing and shoving in a protest. And then it puts, you know, us in the position of saying, like, no, it isn't. And then we're talking about whether or not pushing is violent. And it's like, the common sense is like, well, yeah, no, of course it is violent. And so it's, you know, if we're backed into this corner of trying to say that isn't violent because things have to be nonviolent in order to be good, then we're in trouble because we lose at that level. And then, you know, we bring in the carceral aspect of it, which is that what they're actually aiming for is to establish this slippery slope logic in people's minds between, you know, again, pushing and shoving or spray painting all the way to terrorism. And as we know, in our current situation, you know, in our current, to the extent that there is rule of law still at all, you know, as if you accuse someone of terrorism, you're outside of the rule of law. You can do whatever you want. And so that's the goal, is to be able to associate those sorts of things with terrorism so that you can police them however you want to. And there's severe consequences for that, for the people involved, for our whole society, and for our ability to, impose sanctions on a system that is sending our tax money against our will to a country that's using it to bomb hospitals and refugee camps and kill journalists and starve children. I do think it's massively consequential how we understand these terms, on the ground when it comes to protests.
Okay, so let's go back to 2017, because something pretty important happened at a protest during the inauguration of Trump for his first term. A Black Bloc protester punched a guy named Richard Spencer in the face, and people had a lot to say about it. First of all, what is a Black Bloc protester and a Black Bloc action, and was that punch a defensive action? Was it a protective action? What kind of punch was that?
Black Bloc is a protest tactic where people who are, have the potential, who may or may not engage in any sort of, disruptive activity, all dress alike. They all dress in black and cover their faces. And it's an anti-surveillance tactic that makes it difficult for, police or surveillance cameras to distinguish between individuals in a crowd. It comes from the sort of autonomous leftist movements in Europe in the 1980s. And it sort of quickly spread all over the world. And there's different versions of it. It's not always black, but that's the sort of standard. And it looks imposing. It looks kind of scary. It's definitely there's a lot of overlap with sort of anti-fascist organizing and sort of wanting to be, physically imposing in the face of rising fascism. And that's what was going on in that instance. So Richard Spencer, who was, is credited with coining this term alt-right and kind of really opening the door in a lot of ways to this new popularization of fascism in America.
Right.
And he was there, he was giving an interview about, like a fascist meme, and someone ran up and punched him in the face on camera. I don't think, speaking of, in turn that into a meme itself, and I don't think anything has been more memed.
Or discussed or debated, right, yeah.
Or discussed, yeah. But I mean, that was so widely celebrated.
Yeah.
You couldn't get away from that, just the joy it caused people around the country and the world to see this guy just get punched in the face.
And by the way, that joy is directly reflective of the fact that this guy built his public career around inciting street violence.
Yeah, exactly. And not just street violence, but in empowering state violence to do the sorts of the things that have, that go back to the very worst thing states can do to human beings.
Right.
This is the sort of stuff that this guy supports and wants and is opening the door to. And this is, this is a very old sort of anti-fascist argument that even if we don't believe in any sort of physical violence in theory, the sorts of things that fascists are threatening us with, or physically threatening us with, they demand a physical response at times.
It's not just threatening, they follow through on. We know that they're going to follow through.
That's right.
We can see that it happens. We have the historical record.
And it has happened since then.
Right.
Richard Spencer, again, he opened the door for that. But that, for him as an individual, I mean, that kind of was the beginning of the end for him, because it wasn't the last time he got punched in the face. That part was really celebrated. But, every time he would show up in public, somebody would punch him in the face or try to, and he kind of disappeared off the map.
Yeah.
It's an example of just this sort of baseline. If people are spouting those kinds of politics, those kind of hateful, dangerous politics, sometimes that sort of thing is, you could argue is warranted. And you say, is it offensive or defensive? I mean, I think this goes back to the big violence, little violence thing. If we look at it in the sense of little violence, it's aggressive. I mean, he wasn't doing any physical violence to anyone in that moment. He was standing there being interviewed,
right?
And someone just came and punched him in the face out of the blue. So yeah, that's, in the little violence sense, that's aggressive and offensive. In the big violence sense, it's defensive, because this is a guy who is, responsible for and is trying to spread big violence in the world. And this act was an attempt to shut him up, to stop him. And again, in that, when it comes to this individual, it was largely effective. And so in that sense, we could say it's defensive. So I guess both.
The longer term question is, because he does go into a sort of rapid decline from there. He disappears from public life in about 2 years. The question is, Is that particular moment the threshold of a stronger backlash? Does somebody come in and replace him? Is somebody smarter who comes in and replaces him? Like, I think that when people are reticent about whether or not that's an appropriate action or whether or not it's good to sort of take joy in that kind of defense in terms of, you know, big violence and offense in terms of little violence, then that's the question they're thinking of, is like, is this going to make things worse?
I think things are getting worse.
Regardless.
In our society right now. We're in a moment of rising fascism. That's really scary. I think assessing every individual action or tactic,
and then
zooming all the way out and saying, well, did it or did it not solve all the problems, is just the wrong way to look at things.
Well, it proposes a kind of like science to it too, right? Like that somehow you could track that.
Right, exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of social scientists who try to do that with different types of tactics and approaches. And I think there's a value to that in some cases, but I think we have to calibrate again our views of things. The odds that if there was any one person you could punch and solve all the problems of society, then like, sure, let's like find that person and punch them. But it doesn't work that way. I do think sometimes actions like that can be part of solutions, but part of a much larger constellation of collective action, collective and individual actions. So I think it's better to look at it that way. I also think when it comes to like whether or not people should feel joy, I also think it's kind of the wrong way to look at it, to sort of like think about that morally, like whether or not we should. Like Luigi Mangione is a great example, I think, because we're not talking about like a punch in the face. We're talking about someone who's being accused of murdering somebody in cold blood,
right?
Again, in the abstract, an incredibly heinous action. It caused an enormous amount of joy across American society. Again, the sort of memification of it, which takes it just out of that actual visceral violence of the moment.
Right.
But instead of sort of saying like, should we or shouldn't we, I think it actually is helpful to kind of take a social science approach and just notice that people are.
Yeah, right.
And that tells us something about our society. It tells us something about privatized healthcare. It tells us something about, you know, people who have to choose between, you know, like getting their healthcare and feeding their families, or people who just can't and go bankrupt. Like that tells us something about our society. And I think that's more important than like, should you or shouldn't you feel a certain way?
Well, the should you discussion really, it does actually interrupt that question or that inquiry into, well, how impactful actually is this? I mean, because the response of, you know, that's really in poor taste. This guy has a family, you know, and he's just a regular guy like you. And, you know, he didn't ask to be in his, you know, Titan capitalist job. He just sort of got there and whatever, and somebody else will take his place. And all of that discomfort with the raw vitality and emotion expressed during that moment really kind of obscures why the event takes place at all.
Totally. And I think it's similar with Richard Spencer getting punched in the face. I mean, it showed that people were widely aware that there was this rising fascist tendency, and a lot of people hated it and disliked, you know, and were happy to see someone who a lot of people don't know what to do about it. Someone did this thing in this instance, and a lot of people were happy about that. So that tells us something about where we were at in society. And yeah, people have replaced him, of course. He was not, the whole thing did not hinge on that guy. And, you know, it doesn't mean that the solution is everyone has to punch all the people all the time. I'm not saying that. But I do think those sorts of physically, contentious actions that involve little violence are an important aspect of political struggle, have been throughout history and are right now, especially considering the level of state violence that we're facing and what we, you know, what we might expect in the future if people don't stand up to it.
So in part two, we're going to get into some grittier details. So punching Richard Spencer, the consequences and responsibilities of direct forceful actions. And Ben talks frankly about what combat sports taught him about political conflict. We discuss physical and spatial self-knowledge and resilience. And he points out that the ability to read adversaries during conflict can matter as much as your strategy matters, and that sometimes dignity requires acting without guarantees. So that's a wrap for episode 3, except for, drum roll please, Fascist Dad of the Week. So as I said, in part 2 with Ben Case, I'll be talking about Graham Plattner and his Nazi tattoo. But do you know who hasn't even begun to reckon with or try to apologize for having a bunch of right-wing tattoos all over him? Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Fascist Dad of the Week. He's got a very large Crusader cross on his chest and a Deus Vult on his right bicep. The cross can represent the five wounds of Christ or the spread of the gospel to the four corners of the earth. But in a militant context, it's also a crusader emblem historically linked to holy war imagery. And Deus Vult is kind of in the same category. It's Latin for God wills it. And it was a medieval crusader battle cry during the First Crusade to justify religious warfare against Muslims. So, checks out. Now, recently, Deus Vult has been adopted by far-right and white nationalist groups as a slogan of militant Christian identity and Islamophobia. So, this is the three times married guy with seven kids who's directing that buildup we mentioned in the Caribbean. I'm Matthew. That's it for this week. I'll see you over on Patreon for Ben Case Part 2, or next week back here for a special solo episode where I'll be reviewing a new book by multimillionaire, Democrat whisperer, and podcast junkie Scott Galloway. Take care of each other.